This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning around Australia. This is AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, infrastructure and interest rates. Two of the topics for our talk with the Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. Thousands flee the Turkish bombardment in Syria, and Queensland fast-tracking a crackdown on protests.
This is about as dodgy as our, you know, supposed scrutiny in Queensland Parliament gets. These are the kinds of restrictions on protest laws that we haven't seen for decades in Queensland.
Today we can reveal new details about Australia's role in the wrongful detention of refugee footballer Hakim Al-Arabi in Thailand over summer. The ABC obtained correspondence between the Home Affairs Department and Interpol's Canberra office, which reveals a breakdown in communication between the agencies that were meant to protect the refugee, not place him at risk. Steve Kinnane from ABC Investigations has this exclusive report.
In November last year, Hakim Al-Arabi was arrested at Bangkok Airport after Bahrain, the country where he'd been tortured, placed him on Interpol's red notice list. As a refugee with a protection visa, he should never have been on that list. But the Department of Home Affairs had failed to alert Interpol in Canberra about his visa status. The 25-year-old says he and his wife are still traumatised by the events that saw him jailed for over 2 months and facing extradition to Bahrain.
Sometimes my wife crying until now because she remember what happened in me in Thailand.
Emails obtained by the ABC under Freedom of Information show that the Interpol office in Canberra, staffed by the AFP, alerted Bahrain and Thailand that Hakim and his wife were travelling to Bangkok just before they flew out of Melbourne, and that soon after his arrest in Bangkok, Hakim's fraudulent red notice triggered an inquiry inside Home Affairs about whether the footballer's protection visa should be cancelled. This revelation stuns him.
I don't know what they was thinking. Why they give me a protection visa after 3 years and a half? Oh, they want to cancel my visa. Why they give me a protection visa here?
Home Affairs says it was able to quickly determine that Hakim's protection visa should not be cancelled, and that the process did not get past the assessment stage. But Claire Mallinson from Amnesty International says the inquiry itself is symptomatic of a cultural problem inside Home Affairs.
Well, it's deeply concerning that the first thing that the department thinks about doing is to cancel somebody's visa, and it automatically seems to default to a position of punishment rather than to a position of protecting somebody that the Australian government has already said is in need of protection.
The FOI documents also reveal for the first time the critical email that alerted the Australian Interpol office that Hakim was on a protection visa after he was arrested. That email went unread for 5 days as the officer was on leave, delaying the cancellation of the red notice that had been issued in Hakim's name. Former Socceroo captain Craig Foster, who led the campaign to get the footballer returned to Australia, is calling for an independent review.
The system broke down prior to Hakim's travel, and that was extremely concerning, and we need to see that fixed. So the next refugee who travels abroad shouldn't need that sort of campaign. The system should work well for them, and we need to see greater reform of the system to ensure that that's the case.
Home Affairs says it has conducted its own review, which did not identify any systemic weakness, but did recommend changes, including revising procedures relating to red notices and the use of group emails for sharing information.
Steve Kinnane reporting there. The nation's treasurers are meeting in Canberra today to discuss population, infrastructure, the NDIS and the economy. The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, will be there and he joined me earlier. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Sabra.
By the end of today, will the state and federal government have agreed on a list of 3 or 4 crucial projects that you can crack on with and that will have real practical benefit for Australians?
I think we will make very constructive progress today. Certainly the dinner we had last night had a positive mood to it. Since the last time we met, we've had a federal election and a New South Wales election, and there's an understanding that we need to put our political differences aside and to get on with the job of serving our constituents, namely the Australian people. So there are important issues in relation to infrastructure. We'll be discussing the NDIS, health reform, the population framework and a whole host of other areas.
So on progress, but will you actually say, these are the things that we can agree on, we'll fund these, we'll crack on and get on with it?
Well, yes, we have identified those key areas in relation to heavy vehicle reform, which we need to progress. We've focused on other areas in relation to the NDIS, environmental approvals, we've identified skills, we've identified, and we're also looking at how to potentially bring forward infrastructure projects.
On the infrastructure projects point, the Reserve Bank says that you could spend money now on infrastructure and get the economy revving up. You've got the firm EY recently pointed out that there are plenty of existing infrastructure projects around Australia that could be repaired right now that would boost productivity, create new jobs and benefit everybody. Is that an idea that you're going to adopt?
Well, certainly there are possibilities to bring forward projects, and we do need to agree with them, and they're perhaps not using the Tier 1 and Tier 2 contractors but using some of the smaller players, because we are hitting capacity constraints, particularly in the big markets of Melbourne and Sydney. But you also have to acknowledge, Sabra, that we do have the biggest pipeline of infrastructure projects underway in Australia's history, $100 billion over 10 years. And after 50 years of indecision, we're now building a second airport in Sydney, which will create some 28,000 jobs by the time it's fully rolled out and support them. We've got the Melbourne to Brisbane Inland Rail, which is going to create 16,000 jobs. And, of course, building an airport rail link in Melbourne. So there's a whole series of projects which are creating jobs, busting congestion, that we are working federal and state governments closely on.
What do you say to people who've moved to the city fringes? And we heard earlier this week on AM, people in Tarneit in Melbourne, the promise of great housing, great transport links, but at the end of the day, there's this mad dash from the train station to get to your car so that you avoid a massive traffic jam. There are ghost bus stops where buses never stop. People feel dudded, and they feel that, you know, the words that were mentioned, that ghettos are being built.
Well, in Melbourne, you've seen the fastest growth in a city anywhere in the country. It's growing about 2.5% per annum, about more than 2,000 people per week. And obviously that's putting great pressure on public infrastructure like transport, but also schools and medical services. That's why we as a government have committed more than $27 billion on infrastructure since we came to government. But that's why also today we're seeking to align better federal and state responsibilities. The federal responsibilities are around population, state responsibilities primarily around infrastructure, housing approvals, and if we can better align those responsibilities, share more data, then I think we can get better outcomes.
You say that. In 10 years from now, our population's expected to be 30 million people. Within 10 years, where people look at our cities now, 25 million, we're absolutely struggling now with current demand.
Well, certainly population growth has been much more than forecast. Interestingly, they did an IGR, an intergovernment report, intergenerational report back in 2002, where they expected Australia to hit 25 million people by 2040. As you know, we met that number last year. And there's no doubt that the population growth has focused on Melbourne, Sydney and southeast Queensland. That's where about two-thirds of the population growth has been. I think with better planning, better data sharing, we can get better outcomes.
All right, the Reserve Bank cut official interest rates last week. The big banks thumbed their noses at it. They kept some of it to themselves. You've urged people to shop around. You're going to meet with the bank bosses in coming weeks. What are you going to be telling them?
I'm going to tell them to put their customers first and that it's not good enough not to pass on these rate cuts on in full, particularly as the Reserve Bank has pointed out that their cost of funding has come down substantially.
You've told them that already. You've tried to carpet them and they're just ignoring you.
Well, there are two points here. The first is we are empowering consumers to more easily move banks, and we're doing that with the passage through the Parliament of the Consumer Data Right. But secondly, of the 75 basis basis point rate cuts that we've seen. We've seen the banks pass on 57 basis points of that. So that's not insignificant. For someone who has a mortgage on a $400,000 on their home, that means a saving of more than $1,500 a year in lower interest payments. But we expect the banks to do more. That will be my message to them.
Okay, the IMF overnight has said global warming is a clear and present threat and that there perhaps should be a global carbon tax to cut emissions, that it's more effective than government interventions like direct action. Would Australia accept a global carbon tax?
No.
Treasurer, thank you very much for joining the program.
Good to be with you.
The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. The morning tea break at that meeting might be a tad awkward for the West Australian and South Australian treasurers. WA stepped up its attempt to steal a multi-billion dollar defence contract from South Australia. State government officials have been in Sydney this week at an international maritime conference lobbying the case to shift all the maintenance work on the current Collins-class submarines from Adelaide to Perth. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
It's a political and economic raid with little doubt about its target.
WA, the state government is now on a mission to secure all maintenance of Australia's Collins-class submarines.
We have highly skilled apprentices ready to go, with more than 3,000 jobs to be created over the coming decade.
$500,000 is being spent on this national ad campaign as the WA government tries to get the maintenance of the existing Collins-class submarine fleet switched from Adelaide to Perth. Western Australia's Defence Issues Minister is Paul Papalia.
All the Collins-class submarines are based in Western Australia. This is where they're based. This is where they operate from. This is where the maintenance should be done.
If the ad campaign has swayed the WA-based Defence Minister, Linda Reynolds, she's not letting on, saying she won't make a decision until she gets a report from the Defence Force due in December. And even though the WA government reckons the work could generate $8 billion for the state's economy, Paul Papalia insists he's not looking for any favours from his federal counterpart.
Well, I wouldn't want the important defence decisions to be done in a parochial fashion on some sort of pork barreling exercise. In this case, I believe, as I've said, and the state government believes, it's in the national interest to do this.
And with the possibility of thousands of jobs on the horizon, it's also in the interest of businessmen like Jared Hoffman.
We've just put on almost 30 new apprentices for next year. So we're already continually investing and really upping our numbers for future labour and staffing requirements.
He's the third generation of a family-run Perth engineering firm, and the submarine contract would deliver decades of secure work.
I think it's 50 years in total, so that's, they're the type of long-term projects we want to be involved with to sustain our company long-term into the next future generations.
But there's one big politically influential hurdle.
I have been talking to ministers in Canberra. I've had some conversations with our Premier in South Australia. I'm pretty confident that the submarine work will stay in South Australia.
That's South Australian Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick, who's determined the maintenance work should remain where it is. And as the holder of an important crossbench vote in the Senate, he's reminding the federal government of what's at stake if his state loses the project.
We work constructively with the government and we do so on the basis of good faith and when good decisions are being made. And of course, if the government does do things that are not in the national interest, that of course causes us to reflect on that relationship.
South Australia's Premier Stephen Marshall wouldn't respond to the WA ad campaign, but in a statement says shifting the maintenance contract makes no sense because his state already has the expertise to do the work.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. Turkey's pressed forward with its invasion of northern Syria and claims to have encircled two towns and killed more than 100 Kurdish fighters. An emboldened Turkish president has reacted angrily to international criticism of the attack and threatened to send millions of Syrian refugees into Europe. Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey filed this report from the Turkey-Syria border.
Turkish Special Forces soldiers have pushed further into northern Syria, backed by artillery fire, landing on a number of towns and even the major Kurdish city of Qamishli. Thousands of civilians are trying to get out, with many heading to the nearest open border across a pontoon bridge over the Tigris River into Iraq. Turkey's leader says his troops have killed more than 100 Syrian Democratic Forces fighters. civilians have died on both sides. Most of the casualties have been in Syria. In Qamishli, grieving families crowded a hospital corridor. Turkish civilians are also dying. Authorities here say 8 civilians, including a baby, were killed by SDF artillery. Near the concrete fence that divides the Turkish town of Akçakale from Syria's Tal Abyad, one Turkish man stood staring at the hole that had just been blasted in the wall of his home. As you know, we are at war. We were outside the house when an explosion occurred. It was like just 10 metres away. Thank God nothing worse happened. I hope that God protects our country and protects our leaders. On a hill in Akçakale, overlooking Tal Abyad, a group of local men stood watching the Turkish artillery strikes on Syria. The crowd thinned when explosives started to come back across the border and black smoke began rising from the suburbs of the Turkish town. I am surprised by the return fire. I am sorry for our people, but we are with our state to the end. There's been widespread condemnation of the Turkish invasion across Europe, in the UN, from US lawmakers who have vowed to impose sanctions, including some aimed personally at Mr. Erdogan, and even from Israel. Turkey's president was upset at how Operation Peace Spring was being described outside his nation. Hey, European Union, pull yourself together. I say it again, if you try to label this operation as an invasion, it's very simple. We will open the gates and send 3.6 million refugees your way. Civilians are beginning to leave the Turkish border towns too. Loudspeaker announcements urged locals in Akçakale to stay indoors, but some families had had enough. One man had packed his children in the back of a pickup truck for the second day in a row. A lot of people have moved already. We moved last night to somewhere else close by, and we're just coming back this morning, but now we're leaving again. The kids are nervous. We hope nothing too bad will happen. There's no sense yet of how long this operation might last or how far Turkey will push into the big cities and towns. Turkey claims to have surrounded 2 Syrian towns, Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain, and it's moving in a militia, the Free Syrian Army, to help wrest the area from the SDF. This is Adam Harvey in Akçakale in Turkey for AM.
2 Soviet-born Florida businessmen who are associates of Donald Trump's private lawyer have been arrested while trying to leave the United States. They're reported to have helped fund efforts to investigate one of the president's political rivals and are believed to be important witnesses in the impeachment inquiry investigating the commander-in-chief. Here's our North America correspondent, James Glenday.
This investigation is about corrupt behaviour, deliberate lawbreaking.
In New York this morning, the FBI and prosecutors confirmed the arrests of Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who were seized at a Virginia airport before they could board a flight to Vienna, Austria, with one-way tickets. Both men are US citizens. Mr. Parnas was born in Ukraine, Mr. Fruman in Belarus. And US attorney Jeffrey Berman says they're among 4 people accused of violating US campaign finance laws by conspiring to funnel foreign money to Republican political candidates.
They sought political influence not only to advance their own financial interests, but to advance the political interests of at least one foreign official, a Ukrainian government official who sought a dismissal of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
But there's so much public interest in Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman because they're both associates of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and have reportedly helped investigate and peddle unsubstantiated corruption claims about top Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden and his actions in Ukraine. They're thought to be key witnesses for the current impeachment inquiry, which was sparked by a request from Donald Trump for Ukraine to launch an investigation into Mr. Biden and his son.
This is not corruption because it was just called.
Overnight, Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, insisted the US president wasn't trying to blackmail his nation and said he hoped Ukraine would not have an impact on the 2020 election campaign.
That's why I don't want to comment a lot about that, because I don't want this issue to influence the election this or that way.
But that seems a forlorn hope right now. Impeachment is dominating the news cycle in Washington, and Fox News, once one of the president's favourite outlets, has infuriated the White House with a new opinion poll.
51% of those responding say the president should be impeached and removed from office. That's up 9 points from July.
In response, Mr. Trump falsely declared he'd never had a good survey from Fox, and some of the network's most pro-Trump presenters tried to play it down. But the poll is not vastly different to others, which show increases in support for impeachment, a trend that Democrats desperately hope will continue. In Washington, this is James Glenday reporting for AM.
Anti-terror authorities in Indonesia believe Islamist extremists were behind yesterday's stabbing attack on the country's chief security minister, Wiranto. The 72-year-old minister has undergone surgery, as Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
This was the moment Indonesia's security minister, Wiranto, was attacked by a knife-wielding assailant suspected of being an ISIS sympathiser. The assault was caught on camera. As Wiranto got out of his car to board a helicopter from Menes in western Java, a man lunged at him and stabbed him in the stomach. The minister fell to the ground. In the chaotic moments that followed, a police officer was stabbed in the back and two others were also wounded. Wiranto was airlifted to an army hospital in Jakarta where he's undergone surgery. It's understood he's in a stable condition. A 51-year-old man and a 20-year-old woman are in custody. Photos from the scene shortly before the attack showed them loitering in the area. The National Police spokesman, Dedi Prasetyo, says anti-terror authorities are investigating who they were. We suspect the perpetrator has been influenced by radical teachings of the Islamic State group, he says, but we're still investigating whether he's affiliated with Jamaah and Sharut Daulah in Cirebon or Sumatra. We're very concerned about what happened. It's significant the attack happened in Pandeglang district, an area in far west Java long known to have links to Islamist extremism. It's where one of the Bali bombers, Imam Samudra, was from, as was a suicide bomber who attacked Jakarta's Ritz-Carlton Hotel in the early 2000s. And Indonesia's intelligence chief, Budi Gunawan, says the town of Menes is a local base for JAD, the most dangerous terrorist group in Indonesia, responsible for a string of large-scale attacks. From the beginning, we've said we've detected JAD is planning to create instability by waging attacks. It's no secret that Wiranto and Budi Gunawan are hated by groups like JAD and Islamist extremists, some of whom were blamed for inciting the riots that erupted after Indonesia's national elections last April, in which 9 people were killed, and who were accused of plotting to kill both men along with 2 other government leaders. President Joko Widodo has now vowed to hunt down those behind yesterday's attack. I've ordered the police chief and the director of intelligence supported by the military to investigate their roots and firmly act against the perpetrators and their whole network, he said. And just 9 days before President Jokowi's inauguration for a second term, expect much tougher security for him and other Indonesian ministers. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta for AM.
Queensland MPs and legal experts have been given just hours to prepare for a fast-track public hearing into the state's new controversial anti-protest law. After a week of Extinction Rebellion climate protests, the new law's aimed at stopping the use of locking devices. Protesters have been using them to secure themselves to each other and other objects at busy locations, causing a lot of disruption. Isabel Rowe explains.
You step on the road one more time, I'll give you a ticket for jaywalking. Understand me?
Tensions have flared across the country this week between police, the public and climate change protesters.
Let's go!
And now it's shifting onto the political stage.
This is about as dodgy as our, you know, supposed scrutiny in Queensland Parliament gets.
Queensland Greens MP Michael Berkman will be part of a snap one-day parliamentary committee hearing to examine the proposed new law to ban locking devices, the gadgets used this week by many Extinction Rebellion protesters to attach themselves to public infrastructure.
These are the kinds of restrictions on protest laws that we haven't seen for decades in Queensland. And what concerns me as much as anything about these is that they are very deliberately targeted to address a group of people protesting on a very, very serious issue, climate change.
Introduced less than a month ago, the state's police minister had planned to have the law passed by Parliament by the end of the year. Turns out that's not fast enough for Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
I want these laws in place by the end of this month.
It was enough for Committee Chairman Labor MP Peter Russo to call a snap public hearing for today. And at 5 o'clock last night, members were sent 500 pages of submissions to read. Greens MP Michael Berkman says it's not enough time to prepare.
So we don't know which witnesses will be there. It's not even clear whether the police commissioner will be available.
The laws will then be up for debate in Parliament in 11 days' time. The short timeframe is also worrying some lawyers. Bridget Burton is the director of the Caxton Legal Centre.
No one has had the opportunity to consider contrary opinions or even the opinions of people which are similar.
The Queensland government insists the locking devices are dangerous and can be booby-trapped, posing a danger to police who have to unlock them as they make an arrest. But Bridget Burton says she's yet to see evidence of booby traps.
If what we're dealing with really is political protest that's inconvenient and but that is otherwise peaceful, our existing laws ably cover that. If what we're talking about is actual violence, we also have ample laws to cover that.
Queensland is not the first state to toughen its anti-protest laws. New South Wales recently introduced on-the-spot fines and is considering increasing penalties for protesters who trespass on farms. Tasmania too is reworking its anti-protest laws after a previous version was struck down by the High Court. In Queensland, Deputy Opposition Leader Tim Mander has no problems with the government's hasty approach. He just wants the law to be tougher.
The laws that the government are proposing will not stop people hanging off bridges, will not stop people chaining themselves to railway tracks, and will not stop people from gluing themselves to the roads.
That's Queensland's Deputy Opposition Leader Tim Mander, ending Isabel Rowe's report. An academic who blew the whistle about international student admission standards is being sued by his employer after appearing on a Four Corners program. The maths lecturer had been seeking an injunction to stop Murdoch University taking adverse action against him since the program aired. Now the university has lodged a cross-claim and is seeking compensation for the millions of dollars in revenue it says it's lost. Elise Worthington from ABC Investigations reports.
Associate Professor Gerd Schroeder-Turk is a maths lecturer, but earlier this year he told Four Corners he became something more like a counsellor to staff struggling to cope with international students at Murdoch University.
I'm concerned both about the welfare of the students and the well-being of the students, as well as about the academic integrity or the problems related to academic integrity that result from this.
In May, he and two colleagues risked their jobs by speaking out about their concerns for a group of Indian students who were failing courses in higher than normal numbers. Dr. Schroeder-Turk told Four Corners he was concerned the university was admitting international students below its own published English standards and some were struggling.
I've decided that for me, in this case, you know, the integrity of Murdoch University and the integrity of the Australian tertiary education system is more important than where I earn my money.
Now he's facing a claim for compensation that could run into the millions of dollars. AJ Brown is a professor of public policy and law at Griffith University and says this case is unusual.
It seems extremely surprising that any institution, whether academic or otherwise, would counterclaim against a whistleblower, given that that would seem only likely to attract more publicity to the situation and inflame the situation.
Court documents obtained by the ABC reveal after the program went to air, the university tried to remove Dr. Schroeder-Turk from his position on the university's governing body, known as the Senate. The academic is seeking an injunction and orders under the Fair Work Act to stop them. Jonathan Hallett is the West Australian Secretary of the National Tertiary Education Union.
The fact that the representative of academics in the university governing board has taken the extraordinary step of speaking out, and that in response, a public university has tried to not only silence him, but sue him for damages, and that should be a concern to everyone.
Legal expert AJ Brown is worried the case could have broader implications.
And it seems like this litigation, you know, in both directions is testing out some of those limits, some of those hoops, and that can become a very protracted and costly legal battle, which basically ends up discouraging other whistleblowers from coming forward.
Murdoch University's counterclaim alleges that after the Four Corners program aired, the university incurred significant costs responding to investigations from the regulator and saw a drop in international student enrolments. Court documents filed by the university also reveal the Department of Home Affairs has upgraded the university's immigration risk rating to the highest level in the institution's history, making it harder for the university to recruit international students. A Murdoch University spokeswoman said as the matter is before court, it won't be making any comment.
Elise Worthington reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.